Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 136 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and art of game mastery. Not only do I pass along any knowledge I've gained over 25 plus years of running RPGs, I also share wisdom from guest GMs and listener GMs like you. Today, I'll discuss an alternative method for building encounters for D&D that Wizards has provided in the Unearthed Arcana. After some playtesting, I've found this method to be easier and work better than the method presented in the DMG. It's also not nearly as confusing or involved as it may first seem. I also discussed the dangers of getting too used to adjusting encounters on the fly instead of designing them correctly to begin with. And finally, I give some pointers on creating a legendary version of a non-legendary monster to throw at your PCs. So join me on the journey. Together, we can become game masters truly worthy of the title. So I'm excited to share this with you today. I think we'll have some fun digging into this Unearthed Arcana. This is probably going to be the last episode of 2016 and probably the last episode of season 7. So be coming back at you before too long with episode 137 and kick off season 8 of the show. And we'll just keep this thing going. So for this episode, I really encourage you to head on over to the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com for episode 136. There's some references and links there for you, among them the Unearthed Arcana article I'll be discussing, as well as some other episodes that have approached this topic.
This is Shane from the Total Party Thrill podcast, and you're listening to Lex Starwalker on Game Master's Journey.
I want to give a quick shout out to the patrons of Starwalker Studios. The support of the patrons makes this show possible. If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to give a little back, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. Patrons get some cool perks like game material I make for Primordia and access to a special monthly podcast I produce just for the patrons. I'd also like to give a huge shout out and thank you to my tier 4 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve. Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you to all the patrons. You can find out more about becoming a patron by clicking on the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. Today I wanted to talk a little bit about an Unearthed Arcana that came out some time ago about encounter building. So I've actually discussed encounter building quite a bit on this show in regards to 5th edition D&D, partly because it's such a big part of what we do as game masters is coming up with encounters and scenes and whatnot. And also because the kind of mechanical side of encounter building, as far as having some idea before you're in the encounter at the table with your players, having some idea of how challenging this encounter is going to be, because a lot of us want to have some idea of what the challenge level will be, because for a given encounter, you know, maybe we're wanting it to be very challenging. Maybe the only way that the players can succeed is by doing something creative or coming up with some way to go outside the box or something like that. Or maybe a given encounter, we want it to be pretty easy. We want the players to be able to feel powerful and be able to see their characters succeed at something easily or anywhere in between. And various games have different ways to approach this, and D&D has its own ways. Now, we have in the Dungeon Master's Guide in Chapter 3 a system given for building encounters that uses an XP budget, and there's quite a bit of math involved, and my experience with this system so far has been that it's not terribly useful because the encounters really don't end up being as challenging as I think they should be based on using the system. So maybe I build an encounter
that I think will be very difficult and it turns out to be very easy. Or maybe I build an encounter that I think will be fairly easy and it turns out to be very difficult. Or maybe I build an encounter that I think will be hard, but it turns out to be impossible. And as I've said, I've discussed this quite a few times on the show. And I'll have links to all this stuff in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. But just to tell you now, some of the episodes where I've discussed this in the past was episode 64 and 65, Building D&D Encounters, Part 1 and 2. Episode 82, To XP or Not to XP, Random Encounters and Should the Players Always Win. Episode 84, XP and Random Encounters Feedback. Episode 93, Fixing D&D's Broken XP and Advancement System. And episode 98, Designing Adventures and Campaigns for D&D. So if you're as interested in this topic of building encounters as I am, you'll probably want to go check out those episodes and hear other discussions I've had about this and kind of the history, because I've definitely changed my mind quite a few times about how I build encounters in D&D and what I think of the various methods that Wizards has provided. So I started out very much a fan of the encounter building method in the Dungeon Master's Guide using the XP budgets because I was coming from Numenera, which really had little to no guidance on building balanced encounters. And the guidance that that game did have, at least in my experience, I found to be completely useless and not accurate, even more so than what I've experienced with D&D, where you know, encounters would be greatly more or less challenging than I thought they would be. So coming from a game like that to a game like 5th edition, where we have this very kind of granular method of, you know, this XP budget of building encounters, you know, I really liked that. And I thought, oh, great, you know, now I have anything from an easy to a moderate to a difficult to an impossible or a deadly encounter. And I can build this encounter exactly how challenging I want. But unfortunately, in practice, when I started building and running encounters, I found that it didn't really work out that way. This system in the DMG was not guiding me to the level of difficulty that I wanted, and they weren't shaking out in play to be the challenge level that the numbers said that they would be. This Unearthed Arcana is a different method of building encounters. And I thought I would talk about it on the show because I thought it would be helpful to unpack this for those of you that run 5th edition, because at first glance, this document can seem a little overwhelming. It can seem actually more complicated and confusing than the method in the DMG, which many people think itself is very complicated and confusing. And I myself thought that the first time I read through this, I thought this was even more confusing than what was in the DMG. It was even more difficult to deal with. And I didn't think that it cleared things up at all. I thought, if anything, it just made things even more confusing. But then since then, I've really taken some time to unpack this for myself and came to realize it actually is a very simple method. It is much simpler than what's given in the DMG. And I've begun using this, creating encounters for my games that I've run, and I've been much more satisfied with the encounters that I create using this method than I have been with encounters I've created using the method in the DMG. So if you head to the show notes for this episode over at starwalkerstudios.com, I will have a link to the website where you can get this PDF. I'll also have a direct link to the PDF itself, so you can kind of read along in the PDF with me and we can discuss this and kind of unpack this. So let's start with the introduction here, because there are some points made here that I want to discuss. So it says, this edition of Unearthed Arcana introduces an alternative set of encounter building guidelines for D&D. Though this approach uses the same basic math underlying the encounter system presented in the Dungeon Master's Guide, it makes a few adjustments to how it presents that math to produce a more flexible system. Now, I want to stop here and say, in my opinion, I think that this statement is false. I do not think this is using the same math in the Dungeon Master's Guide. And if it truly is, I would love an explanation of how that is. Because if you sit down with the system in the Dungeon Master's Guide and you create an encounter for your party of PCs using that system, and then you sit down and create an encounter using this system, you're going to get different results. They are not the same. So that said, I found this system much more successful in producing encounters that are the desired challenge level that I want, as opposed to the one in the DMG. So I'm just saying here, I don't think the math is the same because you're getting very different results, but I think that the math in this system works better. And it's also a lot less math that you have to do on your end as a DM, which we'll get into that as we explore how you actually use this system. And again, I'm not going to so much talk about how to use the system in the DMG. You can refer to the previous episodes I already mentioned to get more information on that system, because that system is rather complex and very mathy, and it would take a long time just to go through that. So I'm going to assume that you know how that system works already, and we're just going to discuss this new system from this Unearthed Arcana article. So it goes on to say, this encounter building system assumes that as a dungeon master, you want to have a clear understanding of the threat posed by a group of monsters. It will be of interest to any DMs who want to emphasize combat in their games, who want to ensure that a foe isn't too deadly for a specific group of characters, and who want to understand the relationship between a character's level and a monster's challenge rating. So right here, you know, that's important to note these assumptions. You know, we are making the assumption here that as a game master, it's important to you to know ahead of time how challenging an encounter is going to be when you design it. How much of a challenge is this going to be for your particular group of players? Not just some theoretical group of PCs, but the actual PCs in your group that you're running. So that is an assumption that may not be true for you as a GM. Maybe you don't care about that. Maybe you don't care so much about how challenging an encounter is or isn't. Maybe you're doing more of a sandbox style where you're just putting stuff out there, and maybe it's way too challenging for the players, or maybe it's not challenging at all, but you're just representing the world as it is, and you're not worried at all about how challenging or not an encounter is. You're leaving it up to the players to decide, do we want to engage with this encounter or not? And that's a totally valid way to do that. So if that's you, then this is probably of no use to you. Another DM that this might not be terribly useful for is a GM who is more likely to adjust things on the fly. Now, I do enjoy and do use a bit of, you know, adjusting encounters on the fly, just because, you know, you never know for sure how things are going to shake out. But I do think that that's a technique you want to be really careful with, because if you do too much of adjusting encounters on the fly, it can very easily turn into basically cheating. You're cheating your players. The classic example of this is the GM who has an encounter with their bad guy, and the players are doing awesome. They're rolling really well, or maybe the GM just didn't realize how capable they were, and they're in danger of taking out the bad guy in the first round. And the GM doesn't like this, wants this to be this epic battle. So maybe the GM adds a whole bunch of hit points to the monster behind the screen, or does some other form of, quote, cheating to take this, what would be a quick, decisive, easy victory for the PCs, and instead turn it into this long drawn out battle that the GM was envisioning. You know, sometimes that can be appropriate, and sometimes that can be the right thing or the best thing to do for the story and for the drama. You know, maybe you've really built up to this encounter, and if the PCs wipe out the encounter in a single round, it's going to feel anticlimactic and the players aren't going to be happy. You know, so sometimes that's the right choice to make. But the problem is you can get too comfortable doing that, and you can start to kind of rely on that as a crutch instead of properly designing your encounters ahead of time. And you're just like, oh, I'll just adjust it on the fly. And the problem can be, if you're doing this too much, the players can catch wind of it, and then it's like you're cheating them and they're not going to be happy. So really, I think the best gauge of how you're doing, whether you're doing this, quote, correctly, you know, adjusting encounters on the fly or not, is just look at the impact on the players. You know, if you're in a situation where you on the fly completely change an encounter or add hit points or make some adjustment to the encounter on the fly during play, and it results in the players enjoying that encounter more than they would have if you wouldn't have made those adjustments, then you're doing good, and good on you. Keep doing what you're doing. If, however, you're adjusting things on the fly and it's leading to the players not being satisfied or being a bit disgruntled, or you're hearing comments about the fact of, oh, you know, your monsters always seem to have just enough hit points that it takes five rounds to take them out or something like that, then you might want to look at what you're doing and maybe reconsider what you're doing or how you're doing it. But I guess that's a whole topic for another day. I don't want to get too deep down that rabbit hole. So again, you know, this method is making the assumption that you want to be able to plan the encounter ahead of time, and you want to be able to kind of set that difficulty dial where you want it and have it be fairly accurate. So if I'm trying to make a difficult encounter, I don't want it to turn out to be easy, right? Or if I'm trying to make an encounter that's a challenge but is beatable, I don't want it to be impossible and I'm going to have a TPK on my hands. Now, granted, there's always going to be situational things that you can't plan for as a GM. So maybe there's a certain spell that is just going to make your really challenging encounter a cakewalk, and you don't plan on the players using that spell, or something like that happens. And things like that you can't always plan for. So there, you know, even the best laid plans don't survive contact with the players, right? But it is nice to have a system where we can have some degree of certainty that, you know, this is going to be the level of challenge that we want it to be. So that is what this is for. So it goes on to say, building an encounter using these new guidelines breaks down into a series of simple steps. So step one is assess the characters. To build an encounter using this system, first take stock of the player characters. This system uses the characters' levels to determine the number and challenge rating of creatures you can pit them against without making a fight too hard or too easy. But though character level is important, you should also take note of each character's hit point maximum and saving throw modifiers, as well as how much damage the strongest combatants or spellcasters can inflict with a single attack. Even though character level and challenge rating are useful tools for defining the difficulty of an encounter, they don't tell the whole story, and you'll make use of these additional character statistics when you select monsters for an encounter in step four. So this is very important, the step one here of assessing your characters in your group, because every group is not equal, and there are so many options for player characters in 5th edition that it's really impossible to say what a quote standard group would be. You know, a group that has a life cleric in it is going to, you know, face encounters very differently than a group that doesn't. You know, one group may have all this healing capability and they can withstand all this damage and you know, because they've got this dedicated healer that can bring people up during the fight. And that's going to be a very different group than a group that doesn't have that. Maybe one group has a lot of area of effect damage capability that another group doesn't. Maybe another group has very high burst damage, single target burst damage. You know, maybe they've got paladins and assassins and things like that. So any method that you use for encounter balancing in any game that you play, especially a game with as much variety as D&D, you really have to think about your player characters and what they can do, what they can handle. You know, Group A may be able to deal out a lot of damage very quickly, but they don't have much in the way of defensive capabilities. The player characters have relatively low armor classes. They don't have much in the way of healing ability. You know, so they're kind of a bunch of glass cannons, where Group B may not have so much damage output, but they can really take a lot of damage because they've got a lot of mitigation, they've got a lot of healing, they've got really high armor classes and things like that. So you really need to look at your player characters and where they're at to assess, you know, when you're building encounters. And also keep in mind that this is going to change over time. As your player characters gain levels and gain new abilities, you know, these dynamics can change. So maybe they start out and they don't have a lot of defensive abilities, but as they go on, maybe they develop more defensive abilities. Also, as they gain magical items and equipment. So, you know, this is an assessment you need to constantly do, not just once at the beginning of the campaign and you're set. You know, this is going to change over time. So that's step one, assess your characters. Fairly straightforward, or at least as straightforward as something like this can be. Step two, then, is encounter size. Determine if you want to create a battle that pits one legendary creature against the characters, or if you want to use multiple monsters. So this is a pretty easy decision to make, right? Are you wanting like a boss fight where there's just one badass monster that the player characters are against? Or do you want there to be more than one opponent? You know, maybe there's, you know, one powerful kind of boss type opponent with a couple lieutenants. Or maybe you want a battle with a high number of opponents that are less powerful. Just kind of a general, you know, is it against one opponent or more than one is basically what we're deciding at this point. If you want to use a single monster, you're typically best off using a legendary monster, all of which are specifically designed to make life interesting for a group. So basically, we're just saying here, if there's only going to be one opponent, that opponent should be a legendary opponent. And it's actually fairly easy to take a non-legendary monster and make it legendary. We're not really given explicit direction in how to do this anywhere that I've found in the game, whether that's in the DMG or in one of these Unearthed Arcanas. But it's actually pretty easy to figure out how to do this. If you look through the monster manual and you look at the legendary monsters that are provided, they all have some certain things in common. First of all, you know, your legendary monster will probably have legendary resistance, I believe it's called, which is basically the ability 3 times a day to succeed at a saving throw it failed at. So this is something you can add or not. You know, this is kind of a defensive part of the monster, you know. So if you want this monster to have some staying power and have the usual defensive abilities that a legendary monster would have, then I would give them the legendary resistance and give it to them 3 times per day. And again, you could kind of dial this up or down a little bit by adjusting that times per day. I wouldn't go more than 3 times per day because I haven't seen a legendary monster that has more than 3 of those per day, but you could go less. So maybe you're like, well, I want it to have some staying power, but maybe not quite as much as your average legendary monster. So maybe it can only use its legendary resistance once per day or twice per day. Maybe you're going to take a hobgoblin and make a legendary hobgoblin. So you just give them legendary resistance 1, 2, or 3 times per day. The other big thing that makes a legendary monster legendary is they have legendary actions. And these are actions that they take at the end of an opponent's turn. And seems like the maximum for this is usually 3 of those per round. But again, you could make it less. I would here look at action economy, which is to say, how many actions does the monster have in a round compared to how many actions do the player characters have in a round total? So let's say, you know, you're looking at relatively low level characters like 4th level or lower, you know, they tend to have 1 action per round, right? And you can kind of ignore bonus and reaction because everybody has the same, you know, everybody has 1 bonus action. Everybody has 1 reaction. Doesn't matter if you're a PC or an NPC or what level you are, that never changes. So you can kind of ignore bonus actions and reactions because they're pretty much equal. So you're looking at actions. So, you know, 1st to 4th level PCs have 1 action per round. So if you have 4 PCs, that's 4 actions a round. So you look at your legendary hobgoblin. Well, let's say I don't have the monster manual in front of me, but let's say a normal hobgoblin has 1 action per round. So if you give him 3 legendary actions, he now has 4 actions a round, which is the same as your PCs that have 4 actions a round. But again, I haven't seen a legendary monster with more than 3 legendary actions, so I would be cautious giving a monster more than 3, but you could experiment, you know, and again, shooting for kind of an equal between how many actions does your monster have compared to how many actions do your players have, you know, so if you're higher than 4th level, you know, some of your players may have 2 attacks around, right? So your fighters might have two attacks around. So maybe you've got four player characters, but two of them are fighter types with multi-attack. So really, instead of four actions around, you've got six. So you stack that up against a legendary monster who has multi-attack of three attacks and then three legendary actions. That's six actions. It's about equal. So that's a way you can kind of balance the action economy between the monsters and your player characters, which this doesn't really even go into that level of detail. But I think if you're going to throw a legendary monster at your player characters, action economy is definitely something you want to think about. So once you've decided how many legendary actions to give your legendary monster, then you need to decide what to do with those legendary actions. What are the options that the monster has to do with those legendary actions? And again, to do this, it's not that difficult to do. Just take some examples from other legendary monsters in the monster manual. So one very common legendary action that you will see is to make an attack. So I would just use whatever your monster's most common attack is and say with one of their legendary actions, they can make that attack. Now, this should be a single target attack as opposed to an area of effect attack. You could use an area of effect attack, but I would say that that would take two of the monster's legendary actions. And again, we see precedents for this in other legendary monsters. Other possible legendary actions you could give your monster is to move its speed. This is another very common legendary action that we see. So if your monster has a speed of 30, it can use one of its legendary actions to move 30 feet. So you can make one of the legendary actions an attack, make one a move, and then the third one could be something miscellaneous. A lot of monsters get the ability to make a wisdom perception roll as a legendary action. So if you think that will be useful and appropriate, then you could do that. Another possibility is letting the monster use some kind of other ability it has. So for instance, another common legendary action we see in monsters in the monster manual is if the monster has the ability to turn invisible, that could be a legendary action. Or to cast another spell that it can use as an ability, or just to cast a spell or a cantrip. Things like that. So again, I would look at the regular actions that your monster has and grab an attack from there, maybe grab a move from there. A lot of times they have three options for legendary actions. So I usually have one be an attack, one be movement, because it's always nice as a DM to have more movement for positioning and things like that. And then the third one, I will either have it be a spell-like ability or perhaps an AoE attack. Or if it's a dragon, maybe a breath weapon. Again, keeping in mind, if I feel like that ability is a little too powerful, I can have it take two of the legendary actions to use that ability instead of one. And other possibilities would be something like making a stealth roll. If maybe the monster is especially sneaky, you could have it be able to make a stealth roll as a legendary action. Really, the possibilities are endless. You know, one way to approach it is to think about running this monster in a combat and what kind of things would you like to be able to do with those legendary actions to not just make the fight more difficult, but to allow you to kind of maneuver things the way you want. That's why I often use movement, because positioning can be a big deal, especially if you're using a grid and miniatures. But even in Theater of the Mind, it can be very handy to be able to move as a legendary action just to keep things interesting. And then finally, when you're creating a legendary version of a monster, you can consider whether to give that monster lair actions as well. Now, obviously, these will only come into play if the player characters are facing the monster in its lair. So if you know for sure that the fight isn't going to occur in the monster's lair, you don't even need to worry about the lair actions. But if you want to come up with lair actions for your monster, again, I would look at other legendary monsters in the monster manual as well as in Volo's Guide. Volo's Guide gives us, for instance, lair actions for hags, which aren't given lair actions in the monster manual. So that can help you as well. The lair actions are a little more individualized than the legendary actions. It seems like most monsters have fairly common legendary actions that they kind of share among them. The lair actions are a little more customized. But you can find a monster that's similar that has lair actions to use for inspiration. But again, it's only even going to be relevant if the PCs are going to face it in its lair and if you decide that it needs to have lair actions. Just because it's legendary, you don't have to give it lair actions. My favorite part of the show is when I hear from listener GMs like you. If you have feedback for the show, whether it's a comment on today's topic or an idea for a future topic, I'd love to hear from you. There are a lot of great ways to get a hold of me. You can email me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com, follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker, Google Plus Lex Starwalker, and finally, you can visit the website starwalkerstudios.com to get links to my Patreon page, YouTube channel, and more. All right, so step three is determine numbers and challenge ratings. The process for building fights that feature only a single legendary monster is simple. The table below shows you which challenge rating to use for a legendary creature fighting a party of 4 to 6 characters, creating a satisfying but difficult battle. All right, so now we have our first table, and this is, you know, where we probably start to lose people. People get a little lost in these tables. The first one isn't too bad, but the ones coming up next get a little confusing. So basically this table, you just look at your character level on the left. So what level are the PCs? And then on the right, you have a column for are there 6 PCs, 5 PCs, or 4 PCs. So let's take a group of level 4 characters. At 4th level, if you have 6 PCs, this is saying they can handle a level 6 or a CR6 legendary creature. If you have 5 level 4 PCs, they can handle a CR5 legendary creature. And if you have 4 PCs, they can handle a CR4 legendary creature. Now you notice that the CR is going down 1 as the number of PCs go down 1. So I'm theorizing you could extrapolate further. So for instance, at level 4, if you only have 3 PCs, I'd try a CR3 legendary creature, which is 1 less than the CR4 that you'd use for 4 PCs. Similarly, at level 4, if you had 7 characters, I'd try throwing a CR7 legendary creature at them, which is 1 higher than what you would use for 6 characters. So I'm not sure, I haven't play tested this yet, if that works or not, but it seems to fit the kind of the math relationship going on in this table. So right here, you can see that this isn't the same math that we have in the DMG, because I guarantee you in the DMG, you're never going to end up throwing a monster of higher CR than the party level at them. And this you commonly do, like right here. With a group of 5 level 4 characters, we're told to throw a CR5 legendary monster at them. So not only is it higher CR than the party level, but it's also legendary. So the math isn't the same, but that's okay. So, you know, again, if you're wanting to throw 1 single monster at them, it's pretty straightforward, pretty easy. You make it legendary, you look at this table to figure out what CR that legendary creature should be. Now, something else that's interesting is we're not given any information as far as, you know, if you take a monster that isn't legendary and make it legendary, what impact does it have on its CR? So the way I've been handling it is I don't change the CR at all, which doesn't really make sense, but seems to be kind of the way the system works. So until I hear differently from Wizards, that's the way I do it. Now, of course, if you want to have multiple monsters facing the PCs, it's going to get a little bit more complicated, but really not that much more complicated. And this is really where this system is much more elegant than what we have in the DMG. If you're, I mean, just in a nutshell, if you're going to try to do an encounter with multiple monsters using the DMG's method, you would take the XP value based on their CR, add those together, and then you'd have a multiplier based on how many monsters there are, and you have target numbers based on how many PCs there are and what level they are. And it's a lot of math. It's a lot of adding and multiplying and subtracting and dividing. And you're going to need a calculator probably, unless you're really good at doing math fast in your head. This method, no calculator required, no math required, really. If your encounter features multiple creatures, balancing it takes a little more work. First, you need to determine how many creatures the party will face, along with the challenge rating for each creature. So now we have 4 tables. And this is the part that can get confusing, and there's really a really simple way to keep this from confusing you, which I'll share with you. But let's look at these tables. We basically got four tables, and these are correlating to the four tiers of play. So you have one table for first to fifth level characters, a table for tier two, sixth to 10th level characters, a table for 11 to 15th level characters, and a table for 16th to 20th level characters. Now, this doesn't quite exactly map to the tiers, but it's pretty close. So really, we just have one table here. It's just divided up into four parts based on what level your player characters are. So then when you look at the table, let's look at the first to fifth level table, multiple monsters. We have on the left character level. So you just look on the chart, you find the row that corresponds with what level your player characters are. For simplicity's sake, we'll assume they're all the same level, although you can deal with a group of mixed level PCs using this method. It's just a little bit more involved. But to explain this, we'll just use everybody's the same level. So let's say, again, you've got fourth level PCs. Then you've got columns that correspond to different CR ratings of monsters. And then you have a ratio. So if we look at the fourth level PC row, we see under 1-8 CR a 1-8 ratio. What does that mean? And this is the confusing part. And this is where I'll give you a little tip here to really simplify this for you. The key here to remember is in all of these ratios on these tables, like 1:1, 1:12 or 1:8, 1:8, 1:12, 2:1 or whatever. The key here is to remember the first number before the colon is the number of PCs. The number after the colon, the second number, is the number of NPCs or monsters. So I printed this out, and on my printout, I actually wrote at the top of these tables PC/NPC just to help me remember that that first number is the number of PCs, that second number is the number of NPCs, and it's that simple. So let's look at the fourth level row of this first table for first to fifth level characters. So I have a group of fourth level PCs. So this tells me under 1/8, 1:8, 1:8. So what does that mean? That means if I have my group of fourth level PCs, I want to throw a bunch of 1/8 CR creatures at them, which would be like Sturges, I believe, or CR 1/8. This tells me ratio 1:8. Remember, the first number is PC, second number is NPC. So that means that one PC, one fourth level PC equals 8 CR 1/8 NPCs. Okay? It's that simple. That's all that means. So that means that if I had one fourth level PC, I should be able to throw 8 Sturges at him and it'll be a fair fight. Now, it might not really work out that way. I think one PC would be in trouble with 8 Sturges, but that's the theory behind this that you use to build these encounters. It's that simple. So if we keep going across the fourth level row, let's say I wanted to use CR 1/4, which would be like goblins or CR 1/4, then one fourth level PC is worth 4 goblins. So if I have 3 PCs, I could throw 12 goblins at them because each PC theoretically can take 4 goblins. I have 3 PCs, 3 times 4 is 12. It's that simple. CR 1/2. So CR 1/2, I believe, would be like a hobgoblin. Fourth level PC is 1:2 ratio. So that's 1 PC per 2 hobgoblins. So that means each player character could square off against 2 hobgoblins. So if I have 4 PCs, I should be able to throw 8 hobgoblins at them. And again, this math is not the same. If you go to the DMG and you use some of these examples and you do the math, it doesn't work out to be the same, but that's okay. You're going to use one of these or the other. You're not going to use them both together anyway. Continuing across that fourth level row, CR1 is 1:1. So that's where your 1:1 ratio. So one fourth level PC is roughly equivalent to one CR1 monster or NPC. So if I had 4 PCs and I wanted to use a group of CR1 creatures, I would use 4, one per PC. Then when we go to CR2, now the ratios go in the other way. Now it's 2:1. So that means 2 PCs are equal to one CR2 creature. So if I have 4 PCs and I want to use CR2s, they could handle 2 of them, one for every two PCs. Okay. Continue on, CR3 is a 4-to-1 ratio. So it takes four PCs to equal one CR3 creature. So if I want to use a CR3 I only have four PCs, I'd better only use one. If we go up to CR4, it's a 6-to-1 ratio. So that means six PCs equals one CR4 creature, which means unless your party has six or more PCs in it, when they're fourth level, you probably shouldn't be throwing CR4 creatures at them. Now, just to muddy the water a little bit, let's look back at our legendary creature table, the first table, and we see with a level 4 party, if there's four of them, they're recommending a CR4 monster that's legendary. And if we look here on the multiple monsters table, a level 4, they're saying the 4-to-1 ratio would be CR3. So that seems like that's where it gets a little wonky, and you know, there's some problems in this, because one table is telling us that the equivalent to four fourth level characters is a CR3 regular monster, and the other table is telling us that the equivalent to four fourth level characters is a CR4 legendary monster. So I'm pretty sure that a CR4 legendary monster is much bigger challenge than a CR3 normal monster. So these tables don't even jive with each other, but I don't know. I haven't figured that one out yet. If you have any theories, let me know that can explain that. But as I said, I have tried building encounters using these methods, and they've worked a lot better for me than encounters using the method in the DMG. So then, you know, all these four tables all work the same way. It's just breaking it down into the tiers. So first tier, you're going to look at the first table, second tier, second table, and so on. So now using this method, you can build encounters using numerous monsters of different CRs, just like you can in the Dungeon Master's Guide. And you can do it without ever having to get out a calculator or really do any math at all, because you're using these ratios. Okay, so let's take our level 4 party as an example. I've got four fourth level PCs. I'm building an encounter. And let's say I want to use a combination of hobgoblins and goblins. Okay, so hobgoblins are CR 1/2. Goblins are CR 1/4. So I look at my table here, and I see that fourth level PC, each PC would be worth four goblins. Or each PC would be worth two hobgoblins, right? So you can kind of, as you're building an encounter, kind of think of it as who's going to face each PC, right? So I've got four PCs. So I could have one of those PCs is fighting goblins. So I have four goblins, and the other three PCs are fighting hobgoblins. So each of those PCs is fighting two hobgoblins. So I could have six hobgoblins and four goblins. Or I could say two of the PCs are fighting goblins and two of the PCs are fighting hobgoblins. So each of the PCs fighting goblins can handle four goblins. So that's eight goblins. Each of the PCs fighting hobgoblins can handle two hobgoblins. So that's four hobgoblins. So I've got eight goblins, four hobgoblins. So that's how you do it with different CRs in the same encounter. It's really that simple. Now, if you're going to have like a legendary from the first table along with multiple normal monsters, we're not really given any guidance for that. I think you're kind of on your own there. But this will give you a starting point even for that of thinking, you know, what can each player character handle? And I think those are really the two main keys to using and understanding these tables and not being confused by them is first, remembering that first number in the ratio is number of PCs, second number is number of NPCs, and it's showing you an equivalent. So one PC at fourth level is equal to four goblins, CR 1/4, or is equal to two hobgoblins, CR 1/2, or is equal to one CR 1. What's a CR 1 creature? If I can think of one off the top of my head, I think specters are CR 1. So one fourth level PC is equal to one specter. Now, once we go higher than CR1 at fourth level, then it takes more PCs because now the NPC is more powerful. So CR2, two PCs is equal to one CR2 creature and so on. So the first key is there, just remember those ratios. You know, don't be scared off by the ratios. Just remember that first number is number of player characters equals how many non-player characters is the second number. And then the other key to using these and not being confused by them is if you're going to build a mixed encounter using multiple CRs, just pair monsters off with player characters theoretically based on the CRs you want to use. So if I want to use a CR1, you know, how many player characters would equal a CR1, or how many CR1 would equal a player character? And just kind of, you know, obviously in the actual battle, it's probably not going to work out that way, that they square off the way that you figured out the encounter. But that's just to know how many they can handle. And I think if you do those things, if you remember, you know, ratio, first number is PC, second number is NPC. And when you want to do a more complex encounter with multiple CRs, you just break it down per player character. Like, it's really easy to do. You don't have to do any math. You don't have to crunch any numbers. And it's a lot faster than the method in the DMG. And there's no multipliers based on how many monsters there are or anything like that. So then we have, you know, some discussion of this in this document and some examples using these tables given. And then there are a few other really good points that they make. The above guidelines are designed to create a fight that will challenge a party, but which is still winnable. If you want to create an encounter that will challenge the characters with little threat of defeat, you can treat the party as if it had roughly 2/3 of its members. For example, a party of 5 characters would have an easy time of an encounter designed for 3 characters. So there's a little math, you know. If you're like, I want it to be easier, just pretend you have 2/3 as many players as you actually do and balance the encounter, you know, for that number of players, and then it'll be easier. Likewise, you can treat the party as up to 50% larger to build battles that are potentially deadly, though still not likely to yield an automatic defeat. So a party of 4 characters facing an encounter designed for 6 characters would fall into this category. So, you know, if you want to really throw a challenge at your player characters, but they still have some chance of success, but the deck is kind of stacked against them, just pretend you have half as many, again, players as you have. So if you have 4 players, pretend you have 6 when you build the encounter. And then they have another note about weak monsters and high-level characters. To save space on the tables and keep them simple, some of the lower challenge ratings are missing from the higher level tables. For low challenge ratings not appearing on the table, assume a 1 to 12 ratio, indicating that 12 creatures of those challenge ratings are worth 1 character of a specific level. So all they're saying here is, like, for instance, if you look at the table for characters 11 to 15th level, it only goes down to CR1. It doesn't have values for CR1 quarter or CR1 eighth. So they're just saying, if you're going to use those lower CRs that aren't on the table, just assume it's a 12-to-1 ratio, or I should say 1-to-12 ratio. So each player character can handle 12 of those monsters. All right, so that's all step 3. Step 4 is select monsters. Having used the tables above to determine the challenge ratings of the monsters in your encounter, you're ready to pick individual monsters. However, this process is more of an art than a science. In addition to assessing monsters by challenge rating, it's important to look at how specific monsters might stack up against your group, and this is really important here. Hit points, attacks, and saving throws are all useful indicators. Compare the damage a monster can deal to the hit point maximum of each character. And this is where the average damage numbers that were given for monsters come in really handy. Because you don't have to figure that out. You know, if they do 1d8 plus 2 damage, you don't have to figure out what the average is, because they give that to you. It's the number before the parentheses showing the die roll. So compare the damage a monster can deal to the hit point maximum of each character. Be wary of any monster capable of dropping a character with a single attack unless you intend the fight to be deadly. You know, so you want to look at, you know, what's the average damage that monster does. If that's higher than one of your character's hit point total, that could be a problem. Unless, you know, you want someone to die, then don't worry about it. In the same way, consider the monster's hit points as compared to the damage output of the party's strongest combatants and spellcasters. Having a significant number of foes drop in the first rounds of combat can make an encounter too easy. Likewise, look at whether a monster's best attacks are made against saving throws that most of the party members are weak with, and compare the character's attacks to the monster's saving throws in the same way. So this just makes sense when you think about it. If the monster has some kind of ability that's forcing, say, a dexterity saving throw for half damage or something like that, and none of your player characters are good at dex save, none of them are proficient in dexterity saving throws, they don't have good bonuses for that, then that's going to be significantly more challenging than if half or more of the characters did have good dex saving throws. And the same way with the monsters, you know, if you know that your wizard in the party loves throwing fireballs, which, you know, force a dex saving throw, and the monster has a horrible dex saving throw, then, you know, that monster is going to be a little bit weaker against your particular player characters than it might normally be. So those are things you need to take into consideration. What's kind of the art side of this? If the only creatures you can choose from at the desired challenge rating aren't a good match for the character statistics, don't be afraid to go back to step 3. By altering your challenge rating targets and adjusting the number of creatures in the encounter, you can come up with different options for building the encounter. Now, there's one glaring, obvious problem with this method, the way they present it, and that is this method is actually assuming an approach to building an encounter that's actually backwards from probably how most of us actually build encounters, which this is taking the assumption that you're going to say, I want to throw an encounter using CR1, CR2, and CR3 creatures at my player characters. And then you go from there. And I think that the way most of us actually build encounters is we say, I want to build an encounter using goblins, hobgoblins, and ogres. And I don't even know what CR those are necessarily. Those are just the monsters I want to use. And then I go find out what CR they are and figure out how to make it work. So, you know, that's kind of odd, you know, because I never build encounters by saying I want this CR and then what monster fits that. I'm always, this is the monster I want to use. Now, how many can I throw at my particular party? So it's kind of odd that they design this using that assumption. But I mean, it works backwards as well as forwards. So it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, but it is kind of odd. Have you checked out the Game Master's Journey community on Google Plus yet? The Game Master's Journey community is a great place to bounce ideas back and forth with other listener GMs. You can comment on the show episodes, share your own homebrew world, and ask questions of the many experienced GMs that are a part of our community. So I hope you'll check out our community, and I hope you'll join us there. You can find a link to the Game Master's Journey community in the show notes for this episode over at starwalkerstudios.com/Game Master's Journey. All right, so now step 5 is add complications. While many D&D groups are content to look at encounters simply in terms of combat, the reality is that any situation offers the potential for problem solving and role playing. The fun of D&D is that you never know what the players might try next. If you account for the chance that the characters might try to talk to the monsters, you're setting yourself up for a more interesting game. So this is taking this beyond just combat math and mechanics and into, you know, how do we actually make this encounter interesting and more than just a bunch of die rolls? So first, we have monster personality. If you have the time, create names and personalities for a few of the monsters involved in the encounter. You can use the tables from Chapter 4, creating non-player characters of the DMG, use the quick table below, or simply jot down a few points of your own based on a creature's monster manual write-up. During the battle, you can use these ideas to inform how you portray individual monsters and their actions. To keep things simple, you could also assign traits to a group of monsters to capture how the mob as a whole acts. For example, one bandit gang might be an unruly mob of braggarts, while another is always on edge and ready to break at the first sign of danger. So then we're given a table of monster personalities, and you can roll a d8 to generate one of these randomly. So we have cowardly, looking to surrender, greedy, wants treasure, braggart, makes a show of bravery but runs if in danger, fanatic, ready to die fighting, rabble, poorly trained and easily rattled, Brave stands its ground. Joker taunts enemies. Bully refuses to think it can lose. So, you know, not only can this help you flavor an encounter, but it can also be used tactically as a GM to help you decide round to round what a given monster would do. So, for instance, if you decide that this particular monster or group of monsters are fanatics ready to die fighting, then they're going to fight to the death. They're not going to flee. They're not going to, you know, run off in fear when one of them dies or when they're reduced to half hit points. They're going to fight to the death, down to a man, right? But if you decide, on the other hand, that a particular monster is cowardly, then, you know, as soon as it takes half its hit points and damage, or maybe as soon as it takes any damage, it might throw down its weapons and surrender, or it might try to run away. So, you know, not only can you use these personalities to kind of bring more flavor into the combat, but it can also help you a lot moment to moment as you're running the combat to decide, what's this monster going to do? Are they going to run away? Are they going to surrender? Are they going to keep fighting, or what? Next, we have monster relationships. Are there rivalries, hatreds, or friendships among the monsters in an encounter? Even if the characters don't try to talk to their foes, you can use such relationships to inform the monster's actions and reactions during combat. The death of a much revered leader might throw its followers into a frenzy. A bitter rival could slink away as soon as its enemy falls, or a mistreated toady might be eager to surrender and betray its master. So again, we're given a table of 8 sample monster relationships. Six. So you could choose one, you could roll randomly, or you could use this as inspiration to come up with your own. So the ones given here are rival, wants one random ally to suffer, abused, hangs back, betrays at first chance, worshipped, others will die for it, outcast, others ignore it, mercenary, cares only for itself, bully, allies want to see it defeated. So all of these kind of inform you kind of what kind of tactics that monster will use. Is there a point at which it might surrender? Is there a point at which it might run away? Is there a point where it might switch sides and start fighting its companions? Things like that. Next, we have terrain and traps. A few elements that make the battlefield interesting can go a long way toward making an encounter more memorable. As a good rule of thumb, try to set up the area of the battle so it would be challenging even without a fight taking place there. What things might draw the character's attention? Why are monsters lurking here? Interesting area features can help prompt improvisation and keep things fresh. To add details to an encounter area at random, look to the tables in Appendix A, Random Dungeons of the DMG, to determine room and trap features, potential hazards, obstacles, traps, and more. So again, you know, you can just pull something out of your mind, or if you're having a hard time thinking of something, you can refer to these tables in the DMG. You can roll something up randomly. You can pick something or use it for inspiration. And finally, we have random events. Consider what might happen in an encounter area if the characters were never to enter it. Do the guards rotate in shifts? What other characters or monsters might visit? Do creatures gather there to eat or gossip? Are there any natural phenomena such as strong winds, earth tremors, or rain squalls that sometimes take place in the area? Random events are fun because they add an element of the unexpected to an encounter. Just when you think a fight's outcome is clear, an unexpected event can make things more interesting. And another aspect of this too is if you know these things, like let's say you're doing a dungeon and in one room of the dungeon, there's a body of water. So you determine that, you know, some random things that can happen in this area is, well, this is kind of a water source for a lot of the denizens of the dungeon. So over the course of a given day, various monsters from other areas in the dungeon will come here to get water. And this could be useful for you, not only for something random that could happen in an encounter, like if the player characters are in a battle in that area, maybe another monster shows up to get a drink and enters the fray, but it could also be useful if maybe the player characters want to stake the area out. Maybe they find a good hiding spot where they can see this body of water and they say, hey, we're going to hang out here for a whole day and just see what happens. And now you have some idea of what to tell them. Oh, well, every few hours, some creature comes and gets a drink. And they could actually, just staying in this one spot for long enough, they could actually figure out a lot of the creatures in this dungeon just based on what comes to get a drink. They may not know where it is, but they know it's out there somewhere. So this kind of stuff can be really helpful. A number of the tables in the DMG can suggest random events to be added to a location depending on the nature of the encounter setup. The tables used for encounter location, weird locales, and wilderness weather in Chapter 5, Adventure Environments of the DMG, are a good starting point for outdoor encounters. The tables in Appendix A, Random Dungeons, can be used for indoor and outdoor encounters, especially the tables for obstacles, traps, and tricks. So again, there are some tables in the DMG that you can go for inspiration if you're having a hard time coming up with ideas for these random events. So there you go. That's the entirety of what's in this document. We kind of went through it. And, you know, a lot of this is kind of the mechanics of developing a challenging or balanced encounter and how to make it exactly as challenging as you want it to be. Kind of how to know what you can throw at the player characters without it being too much and without it being too easy. And then we also go into other things that you can do to really add dimension and layers to your encounter beyond the mechanics of the game. You know, adding things to the environment, adding things to the monsters' personalities, and things like that. So I find this very useful. And, you know, like I said before, I've started experimenting building encounters with this. And, you know, I had very mixed results using the method presented in the DMG. You know, sometimes the encounters worked out the way I thought they would, but sometimes they were way harder or way easier than I thought they were going to be based on the math. Now, you know, this system doesn't so much have the more granular, like, this is how you make an easy encounter or a medium or a difficult or a deadly. You know, you do have options for making it easier or harder by assuming there are fewer or more players at the table than there actually are, but it doesn't get into these different levels of difficulty. But I found that the levels of difficulty in the DMG don't really work anyway. Just because the encounter is medium doesn't mean it's actually going to be medium in play. So I don't think that level of granularity is really accurate anyway. And, you know, this way, you know, you can just use the method as presented and it should be, you know, a good challenge, but defeatable. Or you can assume you have half again as many players to make it even more deadly. Or you can assume you have two-thirds as many players to make it easier. And you can vary within that. Like maybe you want it to be a little more deadly, but not quite as deadly as if you assumed half again as many players. So say you have four players and you're like, well, I don't want it to be as dangerous as if I build it for six. So I'll build it for five instead of six. Still harder than if I build it for four, but not as hard as if I build it for six. So you can get a little nuance in it that way, but I've built encounters using this and run them in play, and I found that the encounters tend to be truly challenging to where, you know, after every couple encounters, the players are kind of wanting a short rest. Sometimes after one encounter, they're wanting to take a short rest. And, you know, that is the other element of how you can kind of adjust that difficulty dial is whether or not and how often you let them take short and long rests. So you throw one of these encounters at them and it's a little easy and you feel like, oh, that was a little too easy. Don't let them rest before the next one at all. If you throw one of these at them and they barely squeak by and they're pretty bad off, then maybe let them take a short rest or even a long rest. So you can also use that during play to kind of adjust that difficulty where you need it to be. And that's a lot less ham-fisted than adding a bunch of hit points or taking a bunch of hit points away from monsters during the combat behind the screen. And it's a little less like cheating your players that way too, I think. And also the players are less likely to notice that you let them rest or you didn't let them rest and that was something that you changed from how you were maybe planning to do it as opposed to you suddenly adding a bunch of hit points to your boss. You know, I think they're much less likely to notice that you didn't let them rest when maybe you were planning to than you adding a bunch of hit points. So that's how this method works. And I hope that I kind of cleared up some of the confusion around this because this does, when you first look at it, it seems really confusing. It seems really complicated, but it's really not. You know, it's really just understanding how these tables work and especially those ratios on the multiple opponents table just knowing that that first number before the colon is the number of PCs equal to how many NPCs. So if it's 1:2, that means one PC equals two of those NPCs. If it's 2:1, it means two PCs equals one of those NPCs. So let me know, did this help clear it up for you? Is there still some confusion for you in this? And if there is, let me know specifically what you're confused about, and maybe I can address that. And if you've tried this method, and even better, if you've tried both of the methods, this one and the one in the DMG, let me know your experience between the two. You know, how did the DMG method work for you? Did it seem to work or not so much? How did this method work for you? And if you've done both, did you find that one was consistently better or more accurate than the other, or was one easier to use? I think this method in the Unearthed Arcana is just hands down easier to use. I think it's going to be hard to find someone that thinks that the method in the DMG is easier, just because you have to do these mathematical operations in the DMG. You've got to, you know, add up the XP numbers for all the different monsters, and you got to multiply them by a modifier based on how many monsters there are. It's just, you know, I've done enough of those. You know, I use a calculator to do them. You know, some of the simpler ones you can do without a calculator, but when you're building more complicated encounters, you're going to need a calculator. Where with this method, you're never going to need a calculator. You might need some scratch paper to kind of say, like, I would map out my four PCs and say, okay, this PC is going to face off against four goblins, and this PC is going to face off against two hobgoblins, and this PC is going to face off against one specter, just to kind of make sure, you know, I got my ratios there. But there's no math required. So I think this is a lot easier, and I've had better success with it as far as encounters being the level of challenge that I want them to be. And my experience with this so far, I haven't tried building an encounter harder or easier by assuming my party is bigger or smaller than it is. I've just built based on the party I have. And I found that the encounters are definitely challenging. They're not unbeatable, but they're not face rolls either. Like the PCs are taking damage. You know, they're having to use a lot of resources. And I like to run challenging encounters. You know, if I'm going to take the time for us to roll initiative and do a combat, I want it to be a challenge. I want, you know, the player characters to be, or the players, I should say, to be worried. Because that really kind of hooks the players in to the action. When you have a player character making death saves, like, people are paying attention now. You know, people are engaged. And I like that. I'm like, if I'm going to spend the time to do an encounter, I want that level of engagement. I want that level of danger and fear there. And this method has consistently provided that. I've yet to do an encounter with this method that I thought was going to be a good challenge, and it turned out to be super easy. And I've also yet to do an encounter that I thought would be an appropriate challenge, and it turned out to be way too hard. It's worked really well so far. So I'd love to hear what your experience has been with it. Let me know. All right, well, that is going to wrap it up for episode 136 of Game Master's Journey. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed going down this rabbit hole with me. Again, if you have any comments on this topic or anything I've discussed on the show, or you just want to say hi, I'd love to hear from you. Just head on over to the show notes, starwalkerstudios.com/Game Master's Journey, and there are lots of great ways that you can get a hold of me there. I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/Game Master's Journey.